Green Lady Lounge is inconspicuous from the street. The curtains are drawn and all's quiet until... The whole place swoons with jazz. The band is playing from right in the center of the room, so you have to squeeze by to find a seat. It feels a lot like walking onto the set of a David Lynch movie, complete with hypnotic lighting and soundtrack, plentiful mirrors, even a dark red curtain. It's intimate, moody, and the room glows from lanterns and candles. If you were to ask me, should this work? Is this narrow storefront just made for live music? I'd say no, but it does work. In the few short years it's been open, Green Lady Lounge has become a staple in Kansas City's music scene. With a lot of movement on the horizon for music venues in town, Central Standard is asking, how much of a club's success is about details and logistics, and how much is pure magic? I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'd like to welcome John Scott to the show. He's the owner of Green Lady Lounge, the club we just visited. Hi, John.
Hello.
So who is this Green Lady you speak of, first of all?
Who's the Green Lady?
Yeah.
When I was doing the build-out, I'm in there by myself when I do these build-outs, like when I did with Scott Fitness. It's you go into
of
a building.
Of the physical spaces.
Yeah, when I build out the physical spaces, I'm there by myself a lot, and I kind of imagine some muse or what the building needs to do. What would be the right thing to do in the building as far as the decorations and the flow, the feng shui, everything. And when I was building out Green Lady, I'm kind of into science fiction and so forth, and frankly, the Green Lady is one of the Orion women, and I was imagining that she wanted to start a jazz club.
And you are fulfilling that destiny?
Yeah, because the Orion women, they control men.
So. Okay. Well,
I'm doing her bidding.
Yeah, I'm glad you took those orders. I want to welcome Frank Hicks as well. He's the owner of Knucklehead Saloon in the East Bottoms, and he's in the process of opening a companion venue across the street. He's calling it Knucklehead's Garage. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
So we'll get into this more later, but where do things stand with that new addition?
It's ready to open. We had six shows already, but it's ready.
Six shows kind of on the down low?
Not really on the down low. Just they started out, the first one was just a trial run to see how everything was going to do, how the sound system was and all that. And so we've been tweaking each one of them, but it's ready now.
Well, we'll get back to the stories behind Knuckleheads and Green Lady Lounge. But first, Michelle Bacon edits The Deli KC, a local indie music blog. She's also a musician herself, drummer and bassist, right, Michelle?
Yep.
So let's talk about the news that inspired the show. Both The Record Bar and Take Five are looking for new homes for reasons having to do with developers, landlords, the shopping centers where they're located. The Record Bar won't need a new space until its lease is up at the end of the year, but Take Five is closing abruptly this Friday. Both announcements came as a huge surprise.
Yeah, you know, Record Bar has been one of my favorite venues in town from the standpoint of being a musician and just a concert goer. And unfortunately, I never got a chance to go out to Take Five. I heard a lot of great things. You know, the fact that they were able to get so many great acts over there.
And over
as
there.
As far south, it's out in Olathe, correct?
135th and Knott.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's amazing. You know, people talk about location, 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 but really, honestly, it's just, you know, what we're going to get into today about how you treat the bands and how you treat the audience.
As far as whether people want to go there.
Right.
Well, what do these particular places, Take Five and the Record Bar, I mean, maybe you'll be able to speak a little more to the Record Bar, but what do they mean to Kansas City's live music landscape?
I think of them, or Record Bar more specifically, because I'm more familiar with it. I think of it as an institution for Kansas City music, you know, like Knuckleheads and Green Lady. It caters to different types of music. You know, there's a lot of touring bands that come through and a lot of local bands. So as musicians, we really enjoy places like this, like Record Bar, because of the way that they treat the bands, you know, the owners, Steve Tulipana, Sean Sherrill, they are musicians as well. So they understand how much work we put into that sort of thing. So you know, I see that as making it an institution.
You mentioned that the Record Bar is one of your favorite places. Can you explain in a little more detail why, maybe as even a fan and show goer?
Yeah, well, one of the main things is the sound there. They've got professional sound engineers, most of whom are also musicians. So every time you walk in there, sound is good. They bring in quality acts. They promote their shows. They have really good food and drinks. So it's a great place.
Yeah, we're going to get more into the owner's standpoint shortly. Like, and from the owner's standpoint, there are always going to be business considerations, leases, landlords, neighbors, bottom lines. But just speaking as a fan and musician, what makes a live music venue work in your mind?
You know, I think just the attention that they pay to putting, to bringing the acts in that people want to see. Again, food and drink specials, people like that, charging a low cover, and I don't mean, you know, super cheap, but just something that's kind of worth, you know, we're going to spend this money and it'll be worth it instead of charging too much money. So
where would you say that sweet spot is in Kansas City?
What, venue-wise?
Yeah, or as far as how much it costs, like what's a cover charge that wouldn't be too cheap and but wouldn't be prohibitive?
Well, I think it depends on the bands. If you're doing like a local show, I'd say anywhere between like $7 and $10. If you're doing touring acts, you know, honestly, it depends. It's kind of a sliding scale, I think.
How would you characterize the lay of the land overall around here? Do we have pretty good venues as and pretty good variety of venues? Or and do they gel together to make one big, healthy live music scene?
I think so. You know, like as an example, we've got John here from Green Lady, and we've got Frank from Knuckleheads, and they both, I think, cater to a pretty different demographic of music goers, but at the same time, you know, they're gonna have some overlap too. And we've got the rock clubs bringing in local bands. You know, I really think that it's all. Oh, sorry. I think it fosters a really good music community.
Are there any challenges you see?
Well, you know, I think that we're growing in our art scene quite a bit, so there's going to be some growing pains in that. You know, there's been a pretty good amount of venues that have been popping up over the past few years here in Kansas City, and it takes a while for owners and, you know, crowds to know what's going on. Like, as far as owners knowing how to make a good venue, a lot of people that own venues probably haven't owned one before, so they need to do like a trial and error and see what works and what doesn't, and audiences need to be made aware of these places. So
how do audiences become aware of places?
Well, these days I think a lot of it's through social media. Pretty much everything's through social media, so, you know.
Well, Frank Hicks of Knucklehead Saloon, you're trying to fill what people have identified as one of the major gaps in town. I mean, people have been wringing their hands about this for years. The mid-sized music venues, something bigger than a club and smaller than a grand theater or like even an arena. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we just needed a place that, you know, 800 to 1,000, and I had the building just sitting there and thought, you know, why not? So
you had a building just sitting there and thought, why not? But why do you think that this size of venue is important for a city to have?
Well, I think it's important because some of the bands that tour into here, they can't fill some of the big areas. Like, well, they can't go to Starlight because they're too small. And I don't want it to say small, but their audience is not large enough to fill that place. And then it's too large for other venues, you know. So it just needed a place. We used to have the Beaumont, and it was about that size.
Over in Westport.
Yes.
Well, so I want to get your whole story. We'll come back to this mid-size venue idea, but when did you open Knuckleheads?
2001.
2001?
Mm-hmm.
So how did that come about? Had you been planning on opening a music venue?
No, I hadn't. I really hadn't. It was a motorcycle shop that we was trying to as you know, if you've been there, we're obscure where we're at. And
yeah.
We were trying to get people down there, so we started having street parties. And we'd have bands out in the middle of the street on a flatbed trailer, and we'd have, you know, beer kegs all over and bars set up. And so we did that, like, you know, five times a year. And it got to be real popular. Then, so we just decided we started doing that on Saturday. And then Saturday just grew into Friday. Then Friday grew into Thursday. Then Wednesday and Sunday. And
so pretty soon your motorcycle shop's promotional technique became the business?
It did.
That's funny. You know, the East Bottoms is becoming a little hive of activity with local grocer and trendy butcher shop and more in the works. But, you know, back when you're talking about it, wasn't exactly an obvious choice for a music venue that would draw crowds from all over town. And if you had planned that and tried to pick a location, I mean, you might really have totally not even considered the location where you are. Were you surprised when that started happening? I mean, I've been there and seen people who just flocked in from the suburbs.
Yeah, I was surprised because, like I say, it was an obscure place and it was off the beaten path. I mean, you had to really find it. You don't come down there just by it. You don't just drive by and go, hey, there's knuckleheads. I think I'll stop and have a beer. You have to know what you're going there for. But I think that's what made it really nice, too, because then it became you're going there for that reason. You're going to go see a certain band there, and it's a destination. When you start out, you're going there. You're not just driving by.
One of the really charming but unconventional things about a show at Knuckleheads is that you'll be listening to music, having a great time, and then a train will come through, chugging along, blowing its whistle, and that is just part of the Knuckleheads experience. I mean, it's a part that I think people actually look forward to, but it's not a pristine listening environment.
That's true. I mean, when we first started that, I hated the train because I thought, you know, it's disrupting the audience, and the musicians, but most of them really like it. There's a couple that doesn't, but most of them really like it, and they'll play off the train, and they'll go, hey, it's in the key of G, and they'll start singing some train song off of it. You know?
I wonder about the whole listening environment. I mean, we tend to think, I imagine, that you're trying to find this perfect spot, but in a way, does the spot that you find tell you what is the perfect way to be in that spot?
Yeah, I don't think, like a building, you go in and you feel it out. You don't tear the building down and then build it based on what you imagine would be the perfect thing. I mean, that's inefficient, expensive, and ultimately you're likely to be wrong. So, like with Green Lady, I toiled, like, where am I going to put the band? You know, I thought about it. Well, it turned out I ended up putting on the main floor, I put the band where the dartboard floor was, because that's, you know.
What had been in there before?
Belonkas was there, and then it was.
And that was also a music venue.
It was. Yeah, Lori Burrows ran Belonkas. Yeah, and then before that, Sherry had the Pyro Room for a couple of years there, and she sold it to Lori, and Lori then also bought the building. And talk about landlords and the business aspect. It's really key, you know, to have your overhead, your costs while you're trying to grow, to be low. And Lori, my landlord, is. She gets it because she's a small business owner too. So she's made it very easy for me to survive, make mistakes, and still, you know, stay open.
What kinds of, are you willing to share any of those mistakes that you've survived?
Kansas City, the jazz community in Kansas City pines for the Jardines, you know, myth. I'm going to call it a myth.
And Jardines, that's, most people know it, but it was a really, really popular, really entrenched jazz club on the east side of the plaza.
I'm not sure what the truth of the history is now. We hear different people talk about Jardines in a lot of different ways, and it's really interesting. There's a book there for someone, you know, in the future to write about Jardines. It's, you know, it holds a very, very special place in a lot of Kansas City people's hearts. So when you say you're going to open a jazz club, there's a segment of the population that says, well, you're going to have to serve salmon. You know, it's going to be a supper club. You're going to have a cover charge. There needs to be a listening room. And then that's not necessarily so. It's certainly not the environment in which, in the 30s, Kansas City jazz, you know, thrived and grew.
The late night salmon, that wasn't part of that story.
Right. Right, the shush room. I mean, that's not, you know, that's fine. There is that venue, and God bless whoever can figure out how to make that work. But what I was trying to do with Green Lady was make what I call an evangelical jazz club. That is, I'm reaching out to a population. I'm not preaching to the choir. I'm trying to spread the notion that jazz, whatever you want to call it, this kind of music is just really awesome. And come on in. I'm going to make my money, my cover charge, with alcohol sales. And that's the model I've chosen, and that's happened to work for me.
Michelle, what do you hear in this from a music listener's experience? I know you're a musician, but, you know, we're hearing the things that are coming into these spaces as the owners are thinking about creating them. How do those kinds of decisions affect you when you're going to a show?
Well, you know, I think the formula is really different in every venue. You know, I was giving this some thought earlier, just like asking about what makes a good venue, and it's not necessarily having this giant sound system and this really great stage or whatever. You know, like for instance with Green Lady, going back to that, you're kind of entrenched in the music. There's no actual stage. You walk in and you have to walk past the band to get to where you're sitting.
But, yeah, you're in it.
Yeah, but it's great, you know. So I, as a music listener, it's really great to have all of these different venues that, you know, you're just in a different place with the musicians that you're seeing.
Central Standard will pick right back up with the stories of Knuckleheads and Green Lady Lounge. We're talking about finding the right physical spaces for the venues that make music come alive. Join the conversation when we return. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Knuckleheads owner Frank Hicks, John Scott, proprietor of Green Lady Lounge, and local music blogger Michelle Bacon, who edits the Deli KC. We're peeking behind the scenes at what goes into finding a home for live music. Finding or making a home, I should say. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. We'd especially love to hear from musicians and live music goers. 816-235-2888. We were just hearing Frank's story about opening Knuckleheads in the early 2000s after his motorcycle shop hosted street parties that turned into a music venue. Frank Hicks, has anything changed since then that would make opening a place like Knuckleheads a different ballgame today? I mean, it's only been a short time, but a lot's changed.
A lot has changed. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that I do now that I didn't do at first, and I started listening to musicians, especially traveling musicians, what they wanted from a club. And I remember one of the guys, his friend of mine, Watermelon Slim's, a washer and dryer. And I thought, well, you know, it really makes sense because they're out on the road. And so then they want a shower. So I put a showers in, I put washer and dryer in because, you know, they come in and they feel kind of grungy from being on the road. They take a shower, they wash their clothes, and they come out and they do a better show because they feel clean, relaxed, and ready to go. And so just little stuff like that that you don't really think about because, you know, you have showers at your convenience every day, but they don't, you know. I mean, they may just be traveling 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours or whatever, but when they come from, like, Austin, Texas, and you've been cooped up in a car with everybody, you know, in a van or something, then you want to relax. And so you make a nice green room, you make a nice area for them to relax and to freshen up and put on a great show. And that, in turn, makes the audience, because they come to see this artist and they get a better show, so they're, you know, they're happy, and then it makes the club happy. So everybody's, it's kind of a win-win for everybody. So just paying attention to what the artists need or want, you know.
And that's helped you adapt and change?
That's helped me do a lot of things, yeah, because we've got showers in all three places now. We've got washer and dryer in all three places. And so that if you have, and we have had like multiple bands in all stages, so they all have their own green rooms. They all have access to bathrooms. They all have access to showers, and, you know.
So making your musicians comfortable. John Scott, owner of Green Lady Lounge, you've been in this game just a few years now, and I wonder what you hear in the story of Knuckleheads as someone who's been through this process of opening a venue just a little more recently, and a different kind of venue.
Yeah, Knuckleheads, well, this gentleman, you know, he has a vision. He's executed the vision. He's also done it in steps that make sense. And it's grown very organically, and he pays attention, and he makes changes that make sense. So, yeah, he's a success story.
What made you want to open a music venue?
Well, when I'll go back real quick, when I go back to Scott Fitness.
And that's the business you had before.
Right, and I did that for 18 years. And when I got out of that, when I sold Scott Fitness, I believed wrongly and arrogantly that I was going to be very employable, that someone was going to want me to work for them, and I was going to have the easy life of being employed by someone who could have the headaches. And I would just do my job, and I'd do a great job. But no one wanted to hire me, you know? So.
And your fitness club, I mean, you had many locations, and each location was kind of themed. It was a very, I mean, it was a very recognizable kind of business around town.
I think so, and I believe that Green Lady, frankly, is an extension of that and an extension of that business model. With Scott Fitness, I was not trying to... I was trying to reach out to a population and gain a market that wasn't a traditional gym attendee or fitness person. You know, the no contracts, the no sign-up fees, no cancellation fees.
The wood paneling at one location.
That's 2020 Washington, yeah. Right, so they were all themed to make to have a design and decor that would make people feel comfortable. And also, because there were no sign-up fees, people would be more likely to sign up to the gym.
So it's interesting to me that you're coming from this kind of entrepreneurial business background and that you're talking about a business model that applies to both a fitness center and a music venue. How do you think that coming not from a music background but from a business background influenced the club that you created?
Well, I liked the high volume, low risk to the patron kind of model. That is, without a cover charge, people were more likely to come in. And if you believe in what you're offering, both the decor and the service and so forth and the music, then you're going to capture and keep and your patrons, and you'll build an audience over time with word of mouth and so forth. So that's what we did with Green Lady. Was there's never a cover charge. There's live music 7 nights a week, and my focus is on Kansas City jazz musicians. I am not focused on touring acts. I don't care about New Orleans jazz, New York, or anything else. I'm really just focused on Kansas City jazz musicians.
Is that a business decision, or is that a personal preference, like where your heart is in it decision?
Fortunately, those two align, so it's a good business decision, and it's also where my heart is. So it's a matter of pride that Kansas City jazz musicians and musicians in general, however you want to label it, we've got something really fantastic here. And so to be a business that can showcase that product and those people, I feel very proud to be able to do that, and it's lucrative.
It is lucrative.
It can be.
It has been for you?
It has been, yeah.
I want to back up to this point in your story where you've left Scott Fitness and you feel you are very employable. The outside world is not sending that message back to you. And how do you go from there to deciding, I'm going to start a jazz club?
Right. There's a lot of steps missing there, huh? Well, I investigated a lot of jobs and so forth. I worked at night throwing boxes, at FedEx. Worked there for a few months, did a few interviews and stuff. It became very clear that I was not going to be hired full-time at FedEx. And so finally, my aunt calls me, a few years into this, and she says, hey, let's go look at Jardine's, the old Jardine's space. Well, that was a mistake on her part, because then it's like, okay, well... Because she's a big jazz fan. She's been going to jazz clubs since the 50s. She knows the scene, the real deal.
And she took you there hoping that you would buy that space?
Well, she is a business person, and she's smart, savvy. She's not a dreamer. She's very pragmatic. So we both went into that space, and we both left that space knowing that that was not it. But unfortunately for her, she'd already opened that door, so I started looking for other opportunities.
What were there other spaces besides the one that you eventually settled in that you looked at before finding the one?
Yeah, there were a lot. With Scott Fitness, I was always looking, because we had five locations, I was always looking for that next real estate opportunity. So that was something I enjoyed, and it was very important, because anybody can go on the corner of a obviously popular street, you know, and pay a ton of rent, you know, and open a business. But if you're paying attention and you're looking for the sweet spot, the next East Bottoms, for instance, or the get into the Crossroads before the Crossroads get popular, there's the opportunity because the rent's lower. You can get a lot more space, and you can execute your business model without a lot of high rent and expenses. So you, like I said, you can make those mistakes and stay alive. I looked at a lot of bars and a lot of spaces.
How did you end up with the one you've got? I mean, what made that one the right one to you?
I went to look at the Tank Room because Mr. Ahinger was a landlord of mine in the past. I went to look at the Tank Room before it was the Tank Room. I said, yes, that's it. I want it. Love the landlord, love the space. The gentleman, Dustin, signed the lease that week. He'd looked at it before. So then it was gone. So I'm standing in front of the building and I look over and there's this shuttered bar. Oh, that's Belanca's. It's shuttered. How do I get in? Is this thing for sale? And so I began to look. And yes, it ended up being for sale. Got it.
As I hinted before, there's a lot about the layout that isn't totally intuitive or obvious about, like, this is how a really thriving live music venue would be set up. And maybe I am just missing something very obvious there. But when you looked at that space, did you see it? What did you see in that specific space? I know that other clubs had been there, but what did you see in it, just in the bones of that space?
I saw, what I envisioned was a long shotgun bar with an extraordinarily long, physical bar. So it took the eye down the length of the building. So you had this feeling of expansiveness. There was a lot of ductwork from the 70s that was hanging just above your head. That all was removed. So we opened it up as much as possible. And then as far as the placement of the music, as I said, I worried about that. What I ended up with was basically the music down within the audience. And basically at the front, it's kind of the music is in the round. So people can get right up next to the musicians. They're not separated by a stage. Stages are great. And we have one in our lower level, but.
You know, I want to know about your neighbors too. Talk about where you're located and how the location within the city plays into all of this. I want to talk to both of you guys about that actually. But John, where exactly are we when we're at the Green Lady Lounge and who's around you?
So we're between downtown Kansas City, which is thriving, and a destination for visitors to Kansas City, and Crown Center. So we're between those two areas. Half of our patrons now are actually from out of town. They're visiting, and they want to come to the Green Lady, or they want to go wherever to a music venue and see what they perceive as or hear of as authentic Kansas City, you know, music or jazz. The Crossroads is where, you know, are officially located, and the Crossroads is definitely filling back in as the whole city is filling back in.
And do you have neighbors who are happy about live music late at night?
That's a good question. We're not loud outside of the building, so they can't even hear us, you know. Are they happy about having a bar? You know, some are and some aren't. I had some information before I went into the space that kind of about the community and so forth, and I was very careful as I did my work to maintain the license with the Sunday and the 3 a.m., all those important parts.
Explain what you mean by that, though, because we have, I mean, myself included, a bunch of listeners who have never opened a bar, who have never pursued a liquor license. Why are those things? Talk about those.
Well, in my business model especially, since there is no cover charge, right? We make our money, the way we pay for everything is with alcohol. It's kind of like in the 30s where alcohol pays for the jazz. That's what I say. The alcohol pays for the jazz. So to have a license, and liquor sales are highly regulated. So your license is very specific on what you can and can't do. Some licenses allow you to be open on Sundays. Some allow you to have to close at 1:30 versus 3 a.m. And some, you know, you have to sell a larger or a smaller percentage of food. So to have a license that's got all the bells and whistles, that is, you have a Sunday, you're able to be open on Sunday. You're able to be open till 3 a.m. You only have to sell $60,000 worth of non-alcohol. That's an awesome license to have. Oh, and a dance license. Some clubs you can't dance in some clubs because you don't have a license for it.
Whoa. Does the licensing aspect affect you, Frank?
Oh, just what he said, you got to have a license for everything. I mean, so when you go in, that's what you want to do. You want to make sure that when we went in, we didn't know we was going to need a 3 o'clock license. We don't even usually advertise we have a 3 o'clock license because I don't want to stay up that late. Yeah. But we do have it just in case, because a lot of times the band's going over, you don't want to say, hey, just pull the plug and shut them off at 1:30 because it's 1:30, you know.
So there's a lot of planning that goes into this logistically. And then this neighbor piece of it, you know, it seems like you are becoming your own neighbor opening this second venue. That seems like a very convenient way to eliminate the possibility of neighbors who don't like what you're up to.
Well, that's true, because when the building, like I say, when I had the building since 1980, and when it became vacant in 2013 or 14, yeah, last year, I first thought about selling it. Then I thought about leasing it, because I had been leasing there all along since 2011, so I sold it. I sold the business, not the building. And I liked the income coming in. But then I had to put up with, you know, if I wanted to block a street off, I had to have somebody there to give me permission. And I had, you know, I don't know about the Green Lady Lounge, but my place collects so much stuff that you got to have a place to store it. And so I had this perfect storage area across the street. And then I also had this perfect place to make a venue. So I thought, you know, it's my building. I own it. It's free and clear. So why do I want to lease it? Yeah, I will miss the income. But if everything goes right, the income will come back by having the venue. You know?
The Knuckleheads Garage.
Correct.
Michelle, do you remember there was a pretty big fiasco when the Madrid first opened as a music venue on Main Street, just north of Westport? It was the early 2000s, and this guy had fixed up this beautiful old theater, and his weekly salsa nights alone drew hundreds of people. But the crowds and noise spilled over onto the street with people looking for parking and whatnot, and the neighbors were really upset about it. Does this dynamic between music venues and neighborhoods, is that one? I mean, it sounds like both of these guys are lucky that's not their situation, but that seems like it would be a consideration. Late night crowds, drinking, noise.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a consideration in finding a venue that works. You know, honestly, most of the venues that I go to are in, you know, the Crossroads area or the Westport area, Midtown, so there really isn't that much of an issue with those. So
let's talk to one of our callers. We've got Jeff on the line from Quality Hill. He called 816-235-2888 to talk about music venues in Kansas City and what makes them work. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I wanted to talk about why the Green Lady works so well for the jazz community. To start out with, they have established themselves as producing quality groups. There's no group that you can go and hear there that isn't really a great quality group. Having no cover charge allows people to go in, and even though it's based on alcohol sales, the drink prices are not unreasonable. And I am a senior citizen, but it's really encouraging to go in to the Green Lady, and it's absolutely packed with young people. I'm talking about people under 40. So this is very encouraging to those of us who are worried about the future of jazz in Kansas City. And by opening this place and maintaining this kind of quality, this has really helped to assure the future of jazz in Kansas City.
Well, thanks, Jeff. I mean, that is a pretty refreshing answer that basically what makes a good music venue is good music. Michelle, what do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, like I said earlier, there's kind of a different formula for every different venue, different kinds of music. But, you know, if people who run venues are willing to invest in bands, it'll come back. They'll be bringing in quality acts from around the country, local acts that are really great. So, you know, I think it's a really good thing.
Central Standards got to go off to a break. Call 816-235-2888 to participate in this conversation about the music landscape that's live music in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. You have just a little time to chime in on this conversation about Kansas City's music venues. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question or insight about what makes a location work for live music. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our guests are Michelle Bacon, Frank Hicks, and John Scott. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
So, Frank, at Knuckleheads, you're opening up this Knuckleheads Garage, and there's been a lot of excitement around that. You did it through a Kickstarter campaign, and people have been talking about that this is going to be the mid-sized music venue between a club and a theater that Kansas City has been waiting for. Why, I mean, was running one venue with two stages, that was not enough to keep you busy?
That's what my wife asked too. I just saw the need for it because, you know, I love our outside stage and so forth, but in the wintertime you can't do it. I mean, you're limited to, you know, 300-350 people, so you can't put the crowd that you want to outside. So I just thought, you know, with the building like that and the need for that and be able to do it, because the way we do business now, when you have a band that's going to draw 1,000 people, okay, you always worry, is it going to rain? You know, it's going to be, what's the weather going to be like? Going to be too cold?
It was really hot last time I was there, but people were still there.
Well, but I mean, that's what I'm saying. You got to worry about the rain. You got to worry about the, you know, cold or whatever. And so some of these bands come in like in October. It's such a crazy month because you don't know what it's going to be like. So you have a band that's going to bring 1,000 people. And my idea was to have the venue to where everything was set up and you could move the show if you had to within an hour or two. And
that's cool. Mm-hmm. Michelle Bacon of the Deli KC, how does this venue change the music landscape in Kansas City?
Well, it just brings that mid-sized venue back that we've lacked since the Beaumont closed. And, you know, I'm sure that it's caused a lot of bands to avoid Kansas City just because we don't have that here. So it'll bring people back. Having it at Knuckleheads as well makes it even better because we've got an owner like Frank who knows how to treat the bands, and they're going to want to continue coming back. So I think it's a great thing for our city, especially with the resurgence of the arts here, and people are going to realize, oh, Kansas City's a really cool place. So I think it's a great thing.
What kinds of acts have we not been able to get because of this missing link? I mean, are there kinds of music we just haven't been able to hear without traveling?
I don't know if it's any specific kinds of music. I think it's really just those acts that, kind of like what we talked about earlier, are a little bit too big to be in, well, Knuckleheads' smaller room or a place like the Record Bar, you know, like 300, 400 capacity rooms, and acts that are a little bit too small to fit in Sprint Center or Midland.
Let's talk with Paula about something that she is looking for in a venue in Kansas City. Paula in Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. I love hearing all the conversations, and I'd love to go to all these places, but my dilemma is, although I'm an older parent, I have a child who goes with me everywhere. So I'm looking for a venue around town where I can see live music and my kid can join me without being a problem to the other patrons and, you know, enjoy the music as well.
So, Michelle, I'm wondering if this is something you know about, either all ages venues or places where people bringing kids and not necessarily even specific advice, but like, is this a demographic that is being catered to in the music scene?
You know, honestly, I don't know the answer to that. There are a couple venues that will do like earlier shows that are all ages or 18 and over sort of thing. And I know a couple of the venues you can bring in someone under 21 if they're accompanied by a parent. So, but yeah, honestly, I don't know. A lot of, you know, first Fridays are the first thing that come to mind as far as having all ages shows. Record stores are going to do a lot of in stores. But as far as dedicated venues go, yeah, I think most of those are 21 and over.
I'm thinking about age demographics. How do you make a venue either welcoming to a certain age demographic or appeal to them actively? I mean, young under 21 crowds are not the only groups that have their own particular needs and wants and desires.
Yeah, I think your business model, how you from the ground up, you are choosing your patrons. You are picking, you know, who's going to come into your place.
How are you doing that? Give me examples from your own experience.
Well, my bar is very dark and moody, you know. It's also, you know, there's not a stage. We don't have a lot of food. So I am picking a crowd by those choices, those business model and design choices and stuff.
What crowd have you picked that way?
People who are willing to stumble around in the dark, one, you know. but that darkness also encourages a little quieter conversation. And that was a purposeful decision that I made. With the no cover charge, I'm liable to get anybody in. By choosing jazz as my genre of music, I'm also selecting an audience that may not know about jazz, but they will act in a particular way that is probably a better behavior than if I were to have chosen another genre of music.
Hmm.
So these were conscious decisions, and you manage your patron base by those decisions.
Frank, what about you?
Well, I think on the music scene that we're doing, kids are they're welcome with a parent or guardian. We have them come in all the time, and like this last Saturday, we had Enrique from Making Movies brought a band camp down there, and they did a show for about 2 hours. And it was all under, you know, all underage. And there's no problem with that, I see. I mean, you know, of course, we don't want crying babies down there when the show's trying to go on. But
yeah.
But other than that, I mean.
The trains will do.
Trains will do. Trains, if they can take a train, they can take a baby, or not a baby, but a child. So I don't really see a problem in it. I mean, it's. I have several people call all the time and say, hey, I've got a 17-year-old son I want to bring to hear, you know, whoever, Joe Ely. And bring him, you know, it's fine.
Let's talk to Karen in Kansas City. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can you share?
First of all, I love that you guys are talking about all this. I have a local band in town, a local blues band, and my experience with Kansas City and clubs has just been, I think, fantastic. Most of the owners of the clubs really cater to the band. And I was listening to everyone, and like at BB's, I've played there several times, and the owner gets up and introduces the band and makes a big deal out of it. And it's just very, I think, welcoming for local bands. We're on a smaller scale. We've been together about 6 or 7 years and, usually have 6 to 8 gigs, you know, throughout the month. And it's just, I just have seen it grow so much.
If there's one thing that a venue can do that you feel like helps the musicians, what is that thing?
Promote. I do believe that when the club promotes and the band promotes, I think everybody wins. And when they actually talk about the promotion with the band, and I make posters wherever, you know, I'm going to play, and I deliver those posters, and I make sure I'm all over, you know, social media and that kind of thing as well. And I think when both the bands and the venues promote, it just helps everybody. So,
thanks so much, Karen.
Sure.
You know, Karen's point about promotion, I mean, you have to, when you're running a music venue, it sounds like be so many different things. You're creating a physical space for music, so you're like thinking about acoustics and you're booking bands, so you have to know the music very well. You're also promoting things, so you have to know marketing, and you've got to do, it sounds like, food and drink to a certain extent. How do you manage all these different things?
I try to, like Frank has done, he's organically built his business in steps and over time. And I think that's a smart way to go, and that's what I've tried to do over time. I didn't have a big grand opening where I invited everybody to come in and see how much I didn't know yet, you know. I opened slow and quiet, and I did a lot of build-out over time with cash flow. We can make things really difficult, and we can set up expectations and a lot of processes within a business that take up a lot of your time and energy and ultimately don't contribute to your success or necessarily your failure. So from a standpoint of promotions, my expectations of my musicians are that they show up looking sharp. They're wearing a suit and tie or a dress, that they keep their set breaks to 15 minutes, that they perform with integrity and honesty, you know. They connect with the audience. I don't expect them to fill my house. I feel like in my business model, it's Green Lady's responsibility to have an ingrained patron base who's coming to hear good music. It's not easy for me to get people in, but it's very easy to turn people off once they're in. So I just need to deliver a consistently excellent product. I advertise in Jam Magazine. I have two full-page ads. One's for Organ Jazz Trio, OJT, and the other one's for Matt Hopper Trio. It's coming out with a new album.
So you invest in promotion.
Absolutely.
What about you, Frank?
Yes, quite a bit. It also keeps you up late at night too. Now we do with the ink, of course, and then we do social media, quite a bit of that. I have billboards out on I-35, and posters and stuff.
Big operation for you too. Well, you know, part of the deal with the closure of Take Five out south is that Kansas City's jazz community is, in a way, still trying to replace Jardine's. We've mentioned that a couple of times, and places like Green Lady Lounge and Take Five have been a big part of that. So, John, I'm curious from your standpoint about how you satisfy a need as intangible as like a home away from home for an entire community. That's been a big part of the story of jazz all along, is venues that are homes.
And venues are going to come and they're going to go as small businesses do. It's they're no different in that respect. There's a churning, you know. So in Kansas City, there are so many places to hear live music in general, and then also live jazz. So you can go into almost any restaurant and hear a really awesome jazz musician knocking it out up there. They're in hotel lobbies. They're Californos. I saw a great band last night in Californos. There's a bunch of jazz musicians play there all the time. Really, it's hard not to hear live music in Kansas City. It's very accessible.
With what happened at Take Five, and the details of that are still kind of coming out, but it makes a person wonder whether music, live music, can branch out successfully beyond the more urban parts of Kansas City. Are we still looking at a live music scene that is sort of, you know, inside those boundaries?
You know, I think it really depends on what kind of patrons you're wanting to get in. You know, there are some people that will probably never want to leave Midtown, and that's just kind of how it is. But, you know, I think it depends. If the music's there, if the quality's there, I think people will go. People, you know, understand that certain places have a reputation, so they're going to want to go there and see those bands.
Our time is up for today's conversation about live music and its endless search for good homes, plural. John Scott of Green Lady Lounge, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Frank Hicks of Knucklehead Saloon, and pretty soon, in fact now, Knucklehead's Garage. It's been fun meeting you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you.
Michelle Bacon, editor of the Deli KC, I appreciate your contributions.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this discussion and share it with your friends at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be available by the end of the day. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, gathering spaces in the metro. How do you create them? And if you build it, will they really come? Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with special thanks to Andrea Tudhope this morning and always. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date. Next.